Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. I am guessing that some folks have taken off early already for winter break because we know that next week is winter break when people who aren't already in Florida flock to Florida for the week. But I want to wish you all a happy Valentine's Day in advance. Don't forget, you know, that it's coming up. You don't want to forget to get those cards or whatever. An announcement about next week, also to remind you that next week we will have a special program, the Media Unit. Many of you know the Media Unit is a program of Walt Shepard that he's been running for a number of years. It'll be a little bit different. The theme, the show that the high school students are doing for us is called From the Back of the Bus, and that's in a way related to this month, which is Black History Month. And we'll have a chance to ask them questions. We'll also have our district attorney, Mr. Fitzpatrick, will be here, and maybe we'll be able to ask him a couple of questions too. But it is all about the show and the students, so don't miss that. Also, for those of you who are interested, next week at noon on Thursday, Professor Emeritus Ralph Ketchum, history professor at SU, will be speaking at the Institute for Retired Professionals about his book and work about the Madisons, Jamin and Dolly Madison. So don't forget that. All right. This morning, it is my pleasure to introduce our introducer, new member. Many of you know Bob Herz. Bob is now the executive director of the university's Southside Innovation Center. You may recall that several years ago when it opened, or a few years ago, I guess, we did a program there. It's a center of the Whitman School at SU. And Bob also has a long history in Albany, but we don't hold that against him. So. Bob.
Good morning. I'm delighted to be back. I got inducted last week and put to work this week. That's real efficiency. For those of us who have been maybe around government too long, which Sandy kind of alluded to, there was a court case recently that really struck just an incredible amount of interest. It's called Citizens United. Now, not only pundits and bloggers, right, the pajama Hadeen of our nation, weighed in, but extraordinarily, the President of the United States made mention of Citizens United in his State of the Union. He talked, and then one of the Supreme Court justices talked back. So we have this POTUS-SCOTUS thing going on. There was a little strange. I'd never seen anything like that. But as weird as that was, if anybody had looked at the decision, there was a lot of back and forth in the decision itself. Justice Stevens dismissed Anthony Kennedy's majority opinion as, quote, lacking a scintilla of evidence. Wow, that's kind of strange for justices to be talking back and forth. Justice Scalia, right, no stranger to controversy, jumps in and says, I think really just to kind of insult Justice Stevens, he said about Justice Stevens' dissent, quote, the dissent attempts this demonstration in splendid isolation from the text of the First Amendment. Whoa! So as Groucho Marx might have said, this was the most unheard of thing I ever heard of. So here's the question. Was this, as some insist, really a huge decision? If you looked at the blogs or some of the commentary, they were suggesting that it was an example of blatant judicial activism, a misapplication of the free speech clause to corporations, a first step to corporate and union corruption of the democratic process. I mean, this is all stuff that makes the U.S. kind of wobbly on its political foundations. Or was it something less radical, perhaps even a way of getting corporate and union contributions out of their hidden places in what we've all come to understand are 527 entities? To unpack that decision, we have a man with us this morning who is uniquely qualified to speak to the issues of this case. Tucker B. Culbertson, my new friend, we just talked yesterday and met yesterday for the first time, is an assistant professor of law at the College of Law at Syracuse University. He was AB magna cum laude at Princeton, received his JD at the University of California at Berkeley, and he will receive his PhD shortly. Prior to joining the faculty at Syracuse, Professor Culbertson was a fellow with the Center for the Study of Law and Culture at Columbia Law School and a lecturer in political science at San Francisco State University and the University of California at Berkeley. He's written widely on equal protection, fundamental rights, war, and family. Professor, please.
Thank you. Again, good morning. I am going to put this over here. I'm genuinely delighted to be here. The Thursday Morning Roundtable series is obviously quite storied and quite special, and I'm just so pleased to be part of it. So thank you to Sandra, and thank you to Bob for allowing me to participate in this. So I teach constitutional law at SU, and that involves teaching the First Amendment, which is ultimately what this supposedly scandalous case is all about. And so what I want to try to do is lay some of the background for the case, and then in most minimal terms, explain what the case actually does, and then suggest some of the things that one might do in response to the case, right? At the level of political organization, at the level of legislative action, et cetera. Because, as Bob mentioned, the case, this is the case. It's 200 plus pages, the opinion, right? It's massive. And it is a true gift to pundits and law professors. As Stanley Fish, who's a First Amendment expert and a blogger for the New York Times Online, said, he genuinely and earnestly thanked the court for this opinion because he says it's the only teaching resource he'll need for years. Because every possible rhetorical move, right, every way that a justice can explain arriving at a certain outcome, every possible move is in here, right? This is the full playbook, is what Fish thinks. And so my job today, as I understand it, is to leave most of that aside, because that rhetorical posturing, the conflict among the justices, where one claims not to even recognize the jurisprudence the other cites, and one says the other has not even a scintilla of evidence. If we get too deep into those arguments, we again, as Bob said earlier, we miss the forest for the trees. So I just want to sort of put it in some context, because those who would suggest that this is the beginning of the end of democratic order, I think, overstate the issue. And those who suggest that this is business as usual and nothing really changed also understate the significance of the opinion. So, again, this opinion centers on the First Amendment, and specifically the Free Speech Clause. Now, the First Amendment to the Constitution says, among many other things, that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. Commonsensical interpretation would suggest that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech, period. There's only been one justice to ever maintain that absolute position. And in fact, in the couple of centuries and couple of decades since the First Amendment was drafted, we've found that the government can indeed abridge speech in a whole range of ways. For example, we know you can't perjure yourself. You can't go to court and lie and claim that you were simply exercising free speech. You can't threaten other people with violence. There are all kinds of speech that we prohibit because we think that, well, that's not really the kind of speech that the First Amendment's about. The First Amendment is about maintaining robust political debate. It's about maintaining what Justice Holmes called the marketplace of ideas. Right, it's about allowing for a process whereby the best and brightest ideas can be debated and the best solutions can be discovered. And so there are all kinds of speech that we think doesn't really fit into that story. Obscenity, for example, can be prohibited. Right, slander and defamation can be prohibited. And so the question before the court in this case was whether the government should be allowed to prohibit expenditures by corporations, not-for-profit, for-profit, any sort, expenditures by corporations based on the idea that, well, that kind of participation in the electoral process by corporations who have access to vast sums of money, that's not really what the First Amendment was about. So should we allow for that kind of abridgment, or should we instead say, actually, this is political speech and it's exactly what the First Amendment is about? And the fact that it's a corporation involved makes no difference. So first, let me just go ahead and make clear one very important distinction, and that is the distinction between an expenditure, right, versus a donation or a contribution. Corporations are already limited and prohibited from making certain kinds of contributions directly to a candidate, right? Because the concern is that there would be a quid pro quo kind of corruption going on. But an expenditure is something else entirely. An expenditure is where I spend money to run an ad on behalf of your candidacy, but I don't contribute funds directly to you as a candidate, to your coffers. Okay? So this case is dealing with expenditures. Donations directly to candidates have been prohibited to corporations since the 19th century. It wasn't until the late 1940s that expenditures on behalf of a candidacy started to be prohibited. It was 1947 that the Congress first prohibited corporate expenditures. Let's also be clear that these prohibitions we're talking about are criminal laws, right? There aren't civil penalties that are established. In the case at issue here, it was a felony for a corporation or a union to make an expenditure involving a federal campaign within 30 days of that election if it specified a particular candidate. Okay, and so Citizens United, the group that's suing the Federal Elections Commission in this case, had produced and made a film called Hillary, about Hillary Clinton, that took, I would say, a skeptical view about her qualifications for the presidency. They intended to run it on cable on demand. They wanted to take out ads. They weren't allowed to do that. They were not allowed to do that. And so that's the act that they're actually challenging. So the question before the court is, were these particular regulations in this 2002 law abridgments of speech, of corporation speech, right? We're used to thinking about free speech as something that an individual possesses, right? And so a threshold question is a corporation a person? And does a corporation consequently have the rights that a person has? The answer is yes. It's certainly something worth discussing more later on. But the answer is yes, and it has long been yes. So that part of the opinion, which has people sort of very excited, is again quite old. The construction of the corporation as a person with rights dates back to just after the Civil War. So it's a very traditional ruling in that respect. However, the question before the court was whether restricting corporation speech, not in terms of donations, but in terms of expenditures on behalf of a candidate, violated free speech. Well, here's the threshold thing we have to also recognize. Your speech can always be violated by the government, provided they give the court a good enough reason. Right? All of your fundamental rights may be violated, provided the government has a good enough reason. That good enough reason is what they call the standard of review. Right? So in the case of political speech that's been, you know, censored or burdened in some way, the government has to show two things. It has to show that it has a compelling interest, right? And that the means they used were narrowly tailored to that interest. So I just want to be very clear that even with political speech, if the government can meet that standard of review, then the censorship or the abridgment is acceptable. So in previous cases, especially the Austin case, which Citizens United expressly overrules, the court had said that corporate expenditures, this time it was in the context of a state election in Michigan, right? That corporate expenditures could be prohibited around elections. Okay, and so then the question is, well, why? What's the government's compelling interest? And in Austin, the court said, look, the compelling interest is that the vast resources available to for-profit corporations creates the possibility that public debate will be distorted, insofar as certain particular interests, not that have to do with any particular corporation's, business, right? Not that, KFC is going to dominate the conversation and make it all about chicken, but that corporations as such have some shared interests involving economic matters, involving taxation, involving zoning, etc. And they may then unite around particular candidates and thus distort the public debate because they simply have more resources to take out ads, to print posters, to do all the things that we all do in our political advocacy. They have greater resources, and so it might distort the debate. Now, that was a new argument. Previously, the argument in favor of limiting corporate speech around elections had been that it would create the reality or appearance of corruption. Right? The reality or the appearance of corruption. The distortion argument is something different. Right? The question of corruption is, well, if I run a big ad for you and your candidacy, maybe then, you'll catch me on the way back once you're in office. The distortion argument doesn't presume that any actual corruption exists, but just that the very process of the election will be dominated by a set of interests that simply have more resources available to them. So that's the argument that the court has to consider in Citizens United. Now it's about a federal law, and so the ruling here will apply to all states also, right? And so now they finally have the right question to answer this sort of once and for all. So what Justice Kennedy wrote the majority opinion, and what he basically says is, again, if you're going to censor this core political speech, you're going to have a compelling interest, and it's going to have to be narrowly tailored. And he goes through and he explains why the distortion argument isn't compelling. And he says, look, we all amass resources through private engagement with the economy. Right? So I work at SU and then I donate my money to charities, to candidacies, or spend it on posters or take out a TV ad. We all go and participate in the marketplace and then use those resources for political speech. The fact that corporations do so on a greater scale doesn't make them any different than, say, what I would do with my money in the upcoming elections. He said that doesn't make them any different just because they have a lot more money. So this is an important point because it stresses, again, a real traditional approach to rights in the United States. That is to say, rights are understood negatively, not positively. What I mean by that is just this. Freedom of speech is negative. It means the government can't stop you from speaking. It doesn't mean the government is obliged to help you speak. It doesn't mean the government is obliged to create a state of affairs where we all get to speak equally. That's not the government's obligation. The government's obligation is just to forbear from censoring you. Now, if the government had an affirmative obligation to make sure that we could all speak freely, we'd have a very different state of affairs in this case. But it's quite traditional to say, no, the government's only obligation is not to get in your way. Right? So that's what the court does, and the court starts to look at it. And Kennedy, interestingly, says, well, we have a long tradition that says government action that privileges one viewpoint over another, or that prohibits talking about a certain subject, those have always been looked upon as dangerous and unconstitutional. So those are called subject matter and viewpoint discrimination. Subject matter. If the Congress passed a law that said you can't talk about the war, you just can't. Well, that's singling out one kind of subject matter. And that kind of censorship usually doesn't hold up. Viewpoint says not you can't talk about the war, but you can't talk against the war. Right? So it's singling out a particular view on an issue and punishing it or preventing it. And Kennedy says, well, this is kind of like that. He says, by distinguishing between types of speakers, right, by saying that corporations are somehow different from private citizens, you're making a distinction based on the type of speaker, and that's actually really like subject matter discrimination, where you take a topic off the table of public debate, or viewpoint discrimination, where you take a particular side of a debate out of the conversation. Now that's interesting, because that analogy doesn't actually direct the outcome of the case. Right? Because there's a set of rules for subject matter discrimination, viewpoint discrimination, and if he were going to actually do that analysis, he'd then have to go through the tests that those doctrines require. But that's not what he's going to do. But he does spend the time to analogize subject matter discrimination and viewpoint discrimination, which we know are constitutionally suspect. He spends a good while analogizing that in order to disparage this kind of distinction of the corporation. Okay? He spends a lot of time doing that. But one of the things he doesn't acknowledge is that historically, again, you can, as a governmental entity, discriminate based on subject matter or viewpoint in a couple of very narrow cases. One of those is if you're not discriminating against the speech because you don't like the speech, but because it has secondary effects that are dangerous. Right? So zoning ordinances, for example, that say all adult industries have to be outside residential neighborhoods. Right? Well, that's clearly subject matter based. It's saying that obscene business practices, right, we may allow them to be legal, but we don't want them in residential areas. The reason that governments can do that is because they claim they're not censoring the speech. They're responding to the secondary effects of the speech. It's not that the speech itself is bad, but it's that the speech has consequences about which we're worried. So we want to manage it, regulate it, and confine it. If Justice Kennedy had taken seriously the suggestion that distinguishing between corporations and individuals was like distinguishing between viewpoints or subject matter, he would have had to have addressed whether there's a secondary effects issue here, which says, look, you're right. Technically, corporations and individuals, maybe as persons, should be equal. However, it's not about censoring corporations. It's about saying we have certain concerns about secondary effects. And that is the grounds on which the Congress passed these regulations in 2002, and so a different test would have to apply. But Kennedy doesn't do all that. He makes these analogies, and then he moves on to the core question, which is, does it meet strict scrutiny? Right? Is there a compelling interest, and is it narrowly tailored? Whereas if he'd done the secondary effects analysis, the standard the government would have to meet would be lower, right? It'd be lower. So in any case, Kennedy continues to suggest that distinguishing between types of speakers is a problem. That means that the law is not narrowly tailored. Kennedy says that the distortion argument is not a compelling interest. He says that the argument that allowing corporations to spend without limit, right, without limit, in advocating on behalf of a candidate, he says there's no reason to think that that will cause corruption. There's no reason to presume that that would cause corruption. And he says, moreover, the government's other primary argument, which was that, well, now shareholders in corporations are being forced basically to have the entity which they partly own spend resources on a candidate that they maybe aren't so warmed up about, right? And Kennedy says, well, that might be true, but some corporations only have one shareholder. This law only affects corporations within 30 days of an election. So if that were the government's interest, and so this is an avenue for the future, right, for the legislators who are working on this. If that's the government's interest, to protect shareholders from having, you know, the folks at the top decide to use the corporate cash to advocate a particular candidate, if that was the interest, they'd have to write a law that was both broader and narrower. It would have to be broader in that it couldn't just apply within 30 days of an election. It would have to be absolute. And it would have to be narrower so that, say, corporations whose CEO is the only shareholder aren't affected, right? Or to allow for corporate expenditures if you had a unanimous vote or a vote under the bylaws or something like that. So that one interest, at least after this opinion, looks like it could be an interest that Congress could pursue with a properly drafted law. Finally, the court says that the concern about foreign corporations exerting great influence over elections, again, isn't sufficiently served by this law, because if Congress wanted to pass a law that said foreign-owned corporations can't contribute to elections by way of expenditure, they can do that. That'll be fine. But this law is too broad because it applies to U.S. corporations too. Okay, so where are we then at the end of the day with all of this? In some ways, not a lot has changed. Because as Bob mentioned before, when corporations weren't allowed to make expenditures on behalf of your candidacy or your candidacy, they just created political action committees, right? Which are entities associated with the corporation, but are not the corporation itself. And then individual members of the corporation may donate to that political action committee. Their supervisors may suggest very strongly that they do so. And in any case, political action committees have contributed massive funds to elections even while these direct expenditures were prohibited. So I'm not entirely convinced that this massive influx of corporate spending is going to occur based on this ruling, simply because corporations are now allowed to spend as themselves, not as this political action committee they created as their twin. Right? I'm not 100% sure that the actual amount of money spent is going to increase dramatically. However, it is true, as Justice Kennedy points out, that there are only a couple of thousand corporate-based PACs in the country, and there are several million corporations. So it might be that more folks are likely to get involved because PACs are heavily regulated. They have to submit detailed reports in a really, really regular and rigorous way on their activities, where their money's coming from, how it's being spent, right? And now corporations presumably will be able to make expenditures without those kind of regulations. So that might be an issue. However, if the Congress wants to address that, they can. Because Justice Kennedy's opinion got votes from everybody on the court for different parts. Okay? For striking down most of the law, he has 5 votes. But for upholding one part of the law, he also has 5 votes. Namely from the other 4 who disliked all the rest of what he had to say. Right? So he's got 5 and he's got 5. And the 4 dissenting justices joined him in the conclusion that there's one part of the law that can stand. Okay? There's one part of the law that can stand. And that's the part of the law that involves disclaimer and disclosure. So if a corporation chooses to expend funds on behalf of a candidate, it has to officially identify itself in the advertisement or the electioneering program as the sponsor of the advertisement, and they have to disclaim any relationship with the candidate directly. Okay? So if Congress wanted and was able to elaborate on disclosure and disclaimers as far as, now that corporations can spend directly, what kinds of regulations do we want in place so that we know who's spending how much and for whom, Congress has room to work on that. Congress clearly has 5 votes saying, sure, corporations should be able to spend just like anybody else, but that doesn't mean you get to do it secretly. Right? It means that we need and want to know who's spending what and for whom. And so that part of the opinion gives Speaker Pelosi and others who are busy at work trying to figure out what they can do a little room to work with. Okay, so given the fact that the PACs existed before, given the fact that corporations are now simply allowed to spend directly and thus may be actually known and named as the individual entity spending. I think it's possible that, as Bob said, we can view this opinion as leading us towards a more honest and explicit system in which corporations that are already spending tons of money on elections are openly identified as doing so. That's possible. There's room for Congress to set up those requirements. But I just want to put on the table as a last and sort of most provocative possibility for responding to this opinion. So I've said I don't think that this opinion is as radical as some would like to make it, nor do I think it is as benign as others would like to make it. I think it's one opinion in a long line of opinions dealing with the fact that financing of political elections is a major problem for democratic order and governance. Not anyone, not me, has the ideal answer for how to address that. But the fact that you either have to be a millionaire or no one to run for many offices in this country at the state or federal level, that's a problem if we believe the original fairy tales we're told about collective governance and democracy and a Jeffersonian or a Washingtonian tradition. You know, if we believe in that, we may want to think about a different kind of response, not just to Citizens United, but to the cases that came before it, and to the entire sort of field of public financing for elections. Because I think the reason this case has generated so much steam is in large part because there was already a lot of steam built up around the way that elections are financed. So my recommendation for us to consider is an Article 5 amendment to the Constitution. The Constitution, teaching the Constitution to first-year law students is a challenge because the first few pages of it, all they do is describe how elections are going to take place. All they do is describe how it is that this Democratic-Republican experiment is actually going to be institutionalized. So the first several pages of the Constitution are all about election rules. Well, again, that was a couple centuries and a couple decades ago. And technological changes, economic changes, and other changes might suggest that we all very seriously consider adding some amendments to those bits of Article 1 and adding some of those amendments to the other articles of the Constitution that address elections in order to sort of fully and completely address what I think tends to be the central concern here, which is the way in which money dictates democratic outcomes. Thanks.
We have some office holders, we have some journalists, we have some lawyers. We should have some good questions.
Hi, I find your presentation fascinating and infuriating at the same time. On the matter of disclosure, I understand that one of the protagonists in the suit is interested in taking on that issue next. And it just occurs to me, if we make this direct analogy of corporations as individuals, apply it to the Bill of Rights. The individual has a right to privacy, has a right to a secret ballot, and so on. Doesn't this lay the groundwork for eroding this whole idea of disclosure for corporations?
It could, and the arguments will certainly be made. As of today, on the federal Supreme Court, I think that any argument limiting disclosure is going to have a hard time getting 5 votes. Depends how it's written. Depends how it's written. But I think even a privacy argument, again, would have to pass a certain standard of review. And I think, based on Kennedy's language, you got a solid 5 votes to say that pretty robust disclosure requirements are acceptable for right now. Again, another way that this opinion and everything about it may change is when the court changes. Right? This is a 5-4 opinion for all propositions. So one change on the court could change this holding entirely.
Well, what about the idea that this court is a very activist court, went far beyond the parameters of the case in front of it, overruled very recent precedents, that all of that, like Bush v. Gore, was motivated by political considerations, primarily, and that the large legal analysis, he's a smart man and he can write a legal analysis, but the real motivation was not a legal one, but a policy.
Yeah, to answer you directly, I think you have asked three questions. I'll take them in reverse order. Are judicial opinions drafted with an outcome in mind, and are they written like Edgar Allan Poe's short stories, starting at the end, back to the beginning? Often, yes, absolutely. I do believe that there are serious, intellectually honest judges and justices who are trying to do right by the law, not trying to dictate policies. I can't tell you which one's which, but I do believe they exist. I don't know in what numbers or proportions. As far as sort of how far the court went to address issues that weren't in front of it, yes, the court could have taken on this case in a much more narrow way and just said, well, the provisions at issue in this statute seem unconstitutional. Period. And then Congress would have had the opportunity to try and write a better version. Instead, the court said that it absolutely had to take on the question in the broadest manner possible, because to do otherwise would have chilled speech. It would have made people unsure, corporations, nonprofit, for-profit corporations, unions, etc., unsure about whether or not they would face felony charges for getting involved in elections. Now, I think that's genuine, and I think that's real, but I think that the court, like all courts of appeals, have to make decisions whether to answer a question narrowly or broadly. And we saw, just as a counterexample, since 2002, the cases addressing the legitimacy of the Guantanamo detention camps have been answered very narrowly every time they've come to the court. And they passed it back to the executive and back to the Congress and back to the executive and back to the Congress until finally last year they said, no, actually everyone at Guantanamo can petition for habeas corpus to be released. Now, they could have said that the first time the case came to them, right? The first time the executive attempted to strip habeas. They could have said that then, but that issue wasn't really before them. And so it took 7 years. Here they felt it was urgent to go to the core issue and didn't feel so in other areas. That is a moment of absolute judicial prerogative and discretion. And deciding whether to rule narrowly or broadly, I think you're absolutely right, is based on how seriously an individual justice takes the question. And that might be a purely legal and academic seriousness, or it might be a personal political investment.
Good morning. I'm 89 years old. I'd have to live to be at least 25 years from now. That would make me 114 to have your recommendation implemented. And I'd like to find out if we can't do something a little less naive about trying to establish the parameters of what can be done here.
Fair enough. And I personally look forward to seeing you at 114. Because I do think that willful naivete is often the first step towards what becomes later established truths. And I think that the Declaration of Independence is actually even at least as naive as I am, if not more so. But I take your point quite seriously, and I would say that first, all politics starts locally, right? And so certain concerns about, again, disclaimers and disclosures involving corporate expenditures, right? We have to get really specific and really serious with the electoral commissions in our counties and our cities and in our states, first and foremost. It's very easy to get focused on the federal government. And the federal government is certainly very important and exercises a great deal of power. But I think it's very easy, certainly for the commentators, to sort of fall into quarterback syndrome, right? Where all they notice is the Congress and the Supreme Court and the President, but the offensive line is actually doing a whole lot of very important work, right? And so I think that offensive line for us is state electoral boards, and managing to get some kinds of restrictions, restraints, or clarifications at the level of the states, I think is the most important and actually the most strategically effective way, if you dislike this ruling, to get some change made, because the court historically shows greater deference to the states as regards electoral matters than it does to the Congress. They show greater deference to the states out of, you know, our tradition of federalist, et cetera. So I think that active work on defining, maybe expanding, what a disclaimer is and what disclosure requires, and getting pretty, I'm trying to think of the adjective I want to use to not get in trouble. I just think those are the places that the best work can be done the quickest.
When and how did money become free speech?
Right? Because the basic distinction that we're familiar with is that speech is different from conduct. Right? I can't punch you and say, yeah, but I was just speaking. Right? Conduct can be regulated at all times. Speech, however, is supposed to have some other value. Well, it's from the electoral financing cases that spending money comes to be a form of speech. Some of these cases go back a long way. The most sort of significant ones start in the 70s, right? So in Buckley versus Vallejo in 76, they were dealing then with a 1971 election rule that limited all expenditures, not just by corporations, but by individuals. Capped them and said, you as an individual can't, just because you're a billionaire, Bill Gates can't go run as many ads in favor of President Obama as he would like to. Sorry. The fact that you have these resources is exactly why we want to put a cap on how much individuals can spend. Now, that law addressed individuals, unions, corporations. The court struck that part of it down and said, now sure, donations to the candidate, him or herself, can be limited. But expenditures, right, putting up posters, billboards, taking out ads, etc., you can't limit those for individuals, because individuals have a right to free speech. And expressing their belief in a particular candidate is a classic instance of free speech. Political speech. And so that's where it got started. And I think the tension that it brings up and that we have to address is that absolutely one of the classic sort of principles behind free speech, and this is in all the documentation of the framing of the amendments, it's in the Federalist Papers, it's everywhere, is to create robust and effective political dialogue. But in protecting that right to speak, the concern is that we may be, in fact, exactly sort of cheapening, distorting, or negatively affecting that dialogue by allowing those with greater resources greater airtime. And so I think there's a basic question of First Amendment values here, and I think a certain set of arguments could be made against that very long line of precedent that political expenditures are speech. And I think we're two justices away from having Buckley overruled. Right? So, I mean, this, you know, this new novel opinion, sure, we'll give it a minute and see. But I think with a change of a couple of justices, that very premise, that spending in a political campaign, even for an individual, let alone a corporation, is a speech act, that could change.
The question would be, how about the scrutiny of the ads themselves? The question is the ad true? Especially with 30 days before the elections, spending a lot of money, whether it's around Hillary Clinton or the Swift vote. And at that point, there's really no way of discerning or getting back to the issue of the truth of the ads. So I wonder if the court addressed that.
Not directly. Justice Stevens, in his 95-page dissent, made mention of that, among other things. But you're quite right. The reason there was the time limit around the elections was so that ads couldn't be put out in a way that disallowed rebuttal. and that disallowed claims that they were outright untrue, or at least allowed for some kind of response. So then, in response to this case, I do think it would be possible for Congress to pass regulations limiting all expenditures by candidates themselves, by individuals, by anyone within a certain number of days of the election. Just like we don't allow, my mom and her signs down by City Hall except within a certain distance, right? And she's always, trying to get a little closer, and they're always pushing her back, right? We could allow that kind of regulation if it didn't single out corporations as distinct from individuals. If it applied across the board, then the central premise of the court's holding here, that the distinction between corporations from private citizens is unjust, you couldn't have that argument anymore. So I think it's possible.
Two questions, I guess. One is, I'm extraordinarily uncomfortable with that the individual or the corporation equals an individual when the corporation is composed of lots of individuals. And the other is, did the minority opinion have any compelling arguments that could be built upon?
Absolutely. As far as the Justice Stevens opinion, people always talk about dissents are like leaving loaded shotguns around the house, so somebody else can pick them up later and make use of them, right, even though you're, going on. And this dissent by Stevens, I can't do justice to it, but both as regards the limits on corporate personhood and as regards the notion of expenditures as free speech, Stevens has a lot of very well-developed arguments and passages that are gift-wrapped for a majority to take up when they have the votes. It certainly has that. As far as corporate personhood, just to trouble you even more, and I'm sorry for that, but the way this came about, perversely enough, was as a result of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Now, after the Civil War, the 13th Amendment was drafted to guarantee the emancipation, right, of all enslaved persons. Turned out that wasn't enough, because even after emancipation in many of the southern states, there were strict and vicious codes put in to limit the ability of African Americans to participate in court or to serve on a jury or even have the right to a trial in certain circumstances, to reside in certain areas, etc. And so the Equal Protection Clause got passed, which is a part of the 14th Amendment, which said the 14th Amendment does a lot of stuff. One of the things it does is guarantee the equal protection of all persons, not citizens, not the equal protection of the people, but of the person, because the contention in the southern states at the time was, okay, you might be free, but you're not a citizen. That was the contention in the southern states when they enacted what they called the Black Codes. You might be free, but you're not a proper citizen, and you can't be. And that was based on a white supremacist understanding of what was necessary for citizenship. So the 14th Amendment was passed to say, okay, let's just circumvent all that debate and guarantee the equal protection of all persons, period, right? Citizen, non-citizen, whatever. Let's guarantee the equal protection of all persons. Well, the first case in which the Supreme Court made use of the Equal Protection Clause was a case where they found that a corporation had been unjustly subjected to certain kinds of taxing and zoning regulations. And so I suggest this to you because I think it's relevant to understand that the logic of equality among persons comes out of a tradition of dismantling, right, our white supremacist sort of system and society. But its first use was to ensure equality of treatment for for-profit corporations as opposed to individuals. That was its very first use. And so that sort of innovation, I'll call it neutrally, that innovation is so deeply entrenched in 100 plus years of jurisprudence at this point that dislodging it seems difficult. Now, the counter move is to, innovate back. And the counter move is to attempt to say, okay, if you're a person, let's talk about limited liability. And let's talk about some of the prerogatives and protections that corporations are granted in order to sort of allow them to do their business. Okay, if you want full personhood, then maybe you're going to get full personhood. And so there are some ways in which corporate benefits and structures of governance applying to corporations as unique entities might be altered. At the founding of the nation, corporations were illegal. Right? It was illegal to incorporate unless you were a corporation directly serving the public good. Right? Unless you were providing a necessary public benefit. That certainly changed over time, but there's no reason that we can't think about altering the benefits and prerogatives that go with the corporate structure precisely by staying with this whole analysis that the corporation is a person, rather than trying to undo a couple hundred years of precedent.
We have a situation where a donation is being made by 100 people for a full-page ad in a newspaper. They all contribute, and the donation and the ad appears. We have, on the other side, a corporation with one person owning that corporation and decides he wants a similar ad or she wants a similar ad, and the only thing is that she's going to put it in 100 papers. Equality?
Yes. It is equal under the court's current jurisprudence. Now, I have my own understanding of what equal protection ought to have meant and ought still to mean. I'll spare you that. But it's understood to be equal, again, insofar as all of our constitutional rights, and this isn't true throughout the world. I just want to be clear that constitutionalism as a way of doing law and politics exists in a lot of other places than the U.S., right? And many of those places understand constitutional rights to be affirmative in character, right? So equality and equal protection literally means equal outcomes in certain circumstances. So there are places in which the scenario you described would certainly be understood to be unequal. But under U.S. jurisprudence, I think that would be an example of a perfectly equal situation insofar as the fact that they have disparate resources, those 100 people who pooled their money, this one individual with a bankroll and a corporation account, that's just not the government's problem.
It's not very comforting or reassuring to see so many of these very key decisions decided by a 5-4 vote. That means any one of those 9 people can change the outcome by changing his mind. And I don't see where it really tells you what the majority of the country would feel. Has there ever been any move to require a 2/3 vote?
It's a great question. There was talk during President Franklin Roosevelt's court packing strategy days about seriously increasing the number of justices so that he could appoint some folks that would support his legislation, but also changing the way in which voting had to be done so that you had to achieve something like a supermajority on the court. There were some conversations about that. To my knowledge, it's never gotten very far because, again, to make that kind of change presumably would involve some kind of explicit textual amendment to the Constitution, even though the Constitution is very, very spare in its description of the Supreme Court. But you're quite right that these 5-4 decisions are disconcerting. They're disconcerting not only because, well, it could change at any time, but because they're happening so constantly. And many of these opinions, Part 1A has 5 votes this way, Part 1B has 5 votes over here, Part 1C has 3, so it doesn't count. And it takes a real good minute to go through these cases. This one's pretty clean. And there are a lot of them where it's very, very difficult to figure out what the actual sort of holdings are. I think that the concern, though, with that comes out of also a concern about whether and how the court should be exercising this kind of power with a group of nine people over such fundamental issues, are these issues that are not better left to the legislature, given that the legislature is slow and deliberate and takes forever, and that's a good thing, right? Given that debate and hearing and advocacy maybe will improve a legislative decision. So maybe what your question leads to is the suggestion that the court ought to exercise a little more discretion and ought to offer a little more deference to the legislature, which is a body that represents the people and is democratically accountable to the people. The only problem with that is that also historically, though, it's been the court frequently that protects the interests and voices and literal lives of minorities against the will of the majority, right? So there have been a lot of circumstances where the court's refusal to defer to the legislature of the federal government or the states in the interest of minority concerns have produced some of our now most celebrated opinions. So the anti-democratic nature of the court, the capacity to render such a huge ruling with just five people, right? How many of us are there? I mean, why don't we get to decide, right? It is, it's troubling, but then there are other moments where those same formal problems have produced what many believe are the watershed moments of positive social change in our country. And so it cuts very much both ways.
I'd like to remind everyone that this program will be broadcast on WCNY-FM on Sunday at 7 p.m., and thereafter it will be, for about a week, posted on the WCNY.org website, because I know that some of you will want to hear this again and recommend it to friends and members who weren't here. Thank you, Professor Tucker Culbertson.